I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush today said he disagrees with the 9/11 Commission finding that there is no tie between Saddam Hussein and the al-Qaeda network. The Independent Commission is wrapping up its public testimony today, exploring how the U.S. government reacted at the time of the 9/11 attacks. This morning, the Commission issued a report which concludes that the coordinated terrorist strikes overwhelmed all federal government efforts to respond to the hijackings, and that there was so much confusion that at one point, Vice President Dick Cheney was under the impression that U.S. warplanes had shot down two aircraft. Here, Philip Sellico, executive director of the commission, reads from the report, describing communication with the first plane hijacked on that clear fall morning in 2001.
At 8:24 and 38 seconds, the following transmission came from American 11.
We have some planes. Just stay quiet and we'll be okay. We're returning to the airport.
The controller only heard something unintelligible. He did not hear the specific words, quote, "we have some planes," end quote. The next transmission came seconds later.
Nobody move. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll endanger yourself and the airplane. Just stay quiet.
Hearing that transmission, the controller told us he then knew it was a hijacking.
This is the first time the public has heard the chilling voice of Mohammed Atta, who would crash American Flight 11 into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. As officials became aware that other planes had been hijacked, there was massive confusion. Today, commission member and former Illinois Governor Jim Thompson asked General Ralph Eberhardt, commander of NORAD, if things had gone well that day, would it have been different?
If everything had gone perfectly, if all the information that the controllers had gone smoothly to FAA command centers, if all the information the FAA command centers had gone smoothly to the military, the vice president's authorization to shoot down intruding aircraft had been communicated to the pilots, would it have been physically possible for the pilots, the military pilots, to have shot down the airplane that hit the first tower, the airplane that hit the second tower, and the airplane that hit the Pentagon, assuming everything had gone perfectly, everybody was perfectly prepared, focused inward, scrambled, armed, all the authorization there, all the information there, would it have been physically possible for the military to have intercepted those three aircraft before they completed their terrible mission?
Sir, our modeling, which we've shared with the staff, reflects that given the situation that you've outlined, which we think is a situation that exists today because of the fixes, the remedies put in place, we would be able to shoot down all three aircraft, all four aircraft.
Well, joining us again is intelligence expert James Bamford, who has been following the hearings and who has just published a book that, among other things, describes in meticulous detail what did happen in the minutes and hours after the 9/11 attacks. Jim, welcome.
Thanks, Gail. I appreciate it.
Well, these hearings must seem like a bit of deja vu for you, because the simple message both from your book and today's report was that on that day, the U.S. was largely defenseless. And I think many of us are shaking our heads and thinking, how can that be?
Well, exactly. What was amazing is that the entire continental United States was protected by just 14 fighter aircraft based at seven different bases around the country. And most amazingly is none of those bases were anywhere near the two major cities, two most important cities, Washington, D.C. and New York City. The closest ones were in Cape Cod in Massachusetts near New York, and Langley, Virginia, which was a couple hundred miles south of Washington, D.C.
We also found out from your research that NORAD, our split-second high-tech defense system, which costs us billions, NORAD finds out that the U.S. is under attack that morning by watching a $300 TV. What do you think the total effect of these hearings and this information coming out has been on the defense and intelligence community? Are they embarrassed that they were so unprepared for something like this?
Well, I think they are embarrassed, and I think they should be embarrassed. If you remember back soon after the events, the intelligence community and the defense department were saying what a terrific job they did, and they were doing everything they could to try to prevent the public from getting an idea that there was chaos that was taking place. And I think the hearings are excellent because they're actually showing what really went on behind the scenes, and it certainly wasn't pretty.
So when we heard this morning from General Eberhardt of NORAD that if everything worked perfectly, that today NORAD could defend the country against this kind of attack, is that credible?
Well, I hope it is. They probably would have been able to defend themselves against an attack just like the one that happened on September 11th. The problem is the terrorists usually are one step ahead, and they think of other ways to commit their terror. So maybe they've fixed everything with regard to the FAA and NORAD, and we've got another seam that they're looking at in order to break into the society with terrorism.
Well, let's go back to the events of that morning for just a moment. What about the planes that did get into the air and were close enough to intercept one or more of these hijacked planes? Were they even armed?
Well, that was the point. The Secret Service got in touch with a fighter squadron on Andrews Air Force Base, which was obviously very close to Washington, and they were very worried that the White House was going to be attacked. And some of the aircraft there, a few aircraft took off immediately after getting the word, but the problem was they were in such a hurry to take off, they never put any armament on the plane. So the only thing that was that they would be able to do would be to ram the passenger jet and commit suicide in doing that. And a couple of the pilots actually said that they would do that, but it just shows the chaos that took place.
Well, and as you say, at the time we were under this sort of Cold War mentality, but there were plans during the Cold War for the continuity of government, protection of top officials. What was actually happening in Washington as the attacks were underway?
Well, there was mass confusion on Capitol Hill. There was no alarm that went off in the Capitol building. So some people stayed at their desk. Others rushed out of the building. At one point, there was just a mass of senators and Congress people outside wandering around on the sidewalks, not knowing what to do because there was no real plan of action. So at one point, the Capitol Police took them all and brought them up to the top floor of the Capitol Police building, which was an old, decrepit building in Washington. And the only thing they could do was pull the shades down and hope nobody would see them. So it was a rather absurd situation.
Jim, thank you.
Well, thank you, Gail. I appreciate being on your show.
James Bamford is the author of several books on the U.S. intelligence community, including The Puzzle Palace. His newest book is a detailed preview of what we've been finding out in this week's hearings. It's titled A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies.
Senior Pentagon officials say that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld ordered a suspected Iraqi terrorist to be secretly held at a high-level detention center outside Baghdad. The detainee was to be kept hidden even from watchdog groups like the Red Cross. This is the first time Rumsfeld has been directly linked to so-called ghost detainee imprisonment, a practice criticized in the February Taguba report as in violation of international law. Well, now a group called Human Rights First is claiming that the U.S. has a wide network of secret detention facilities around the world. Today, the group is releasing a list of these facilities. Avi Cover is a lawyer with Human Rights First. He joins us from New York City. And Avi, how many facilities are we talking about here?
Through news reports and various sources, we have documented over 20, and it could certainly go over 30 locations where the United States military is holding persons completely secretly without giving information to families as required by international law. They've been denying the International Committee of the Red Cross visits to these locations as is required by the Geneva Conventions.
As you well know, the recent Taguba report has documented some of the things that you're speaking of. And the U.S. government has said that in many cases, if a detainee is deemed to be an Iraqi unlawful combatant, they are outside the protections of the Geneva Convention.
Well, regardless of their status as an unlawful combatant or security detainee, international law still requires humane treatment, and we would maintain that the International Committee of the Red Cross is still required to be able to visit these persons.
That brings us back to the case of the detainee that was ordered to be held by Rumsfeld at the request of George Tenet, then head of the CIA. Are you saying that there are other such ghost detainees who are completely off the rolls and not seen by any monitoring group?
Well, in some respects, what we're talking about is entire facilities.
How many people do you think are ghost detainees?
I think we're talking about a number anywhere between 1,000 and 2,000.
And where are some of the places that these detainees are being held?
Well, certainly there are other locations in Iraq that we know of. There are locations in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. There have been some reports on the island of Diego Garcia, which the United States and the United Kingdom have sort of a leased possession there. There is belief of certain U.S. naval ships essentially floating offshore detention facilities. There is concern that there are facilities in Jordan. There have been some reports of that being a CIA interrogation facility.
Well, officials in Iraq are saying that they sort of lost track of this ghost detainee that was held under the direction of Donald Rumsfeld. Is it possible that some of the ones you're referring to are also just they've got lost in the chaos of war?
We're talking about entire facilities being, created and structured where people are being kept. So this is not individuals being lost. Rather, they are being secreted out by the military. Mm. And I should say the Taguba report and the ICRC report, they point to a very frightening concern, which is that anywhere between 60 and 90% of these people are really innocent of any criminal wrongdoing and certainly don't pose national security threats.
The CIA has said that it has discontinued the ghost detainee practice. But it's also said that Geneva Conventions allow a delay in identifying prisoners, again, in time of war. So they're saying that if they don't immediately name some of the detainees, it's still legal.
Yeah, well, I will say that the Geneva Conventions actually require, there's something very simple called capture cards. And it requires that immediately upon capture, and or not more than 1 week after arrival at a camp, even if it's a transition camp, that individual must be permitted to write directly to his family, on the one hand, and to the Central Prisoners of War Agency, on the other hand. And this card should inform his relatives of his capture, address, and state of health. So that assertion is without validity.
Avi Cover, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Avi is a lawyer with Human Rights First. He spoke to us from New York City.
Just ahead, more than 1,200 women in Guatemala have been brutally murdered in the past 2.5 years, and little is being done about it.
And later, a suicide bomber targets an Iraqi army recruiting station. At least 35 people are killed.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Over the past year and a half, nearly 1,200 Guatemalan women have been murdered, many in unusually gruesome ways. Bodies are turning up around the country, burnt, dismembered, strangled, and decapitated, sometimes at a rate of about one a day. Yet Guatemalan authorities have remained surprisingly silent. Boston Globe correspondent Marion Lloyd has been covering that story. She joins us on the line from Mexico City. Marion, welcome.
Thank you.
This is such a disturbing story. Can you begin by telling us a little bit more about these murders? Do they seem to be tied together in any way? Do the victims bear any similarities between each other?
I think the only similarities are that the majority of the victims are poor with little recourse to the justice system. They tend to be young, probably between about 15 and 35. The only other connection is that a lot of the killings have turned up in pairs. There are probably about a dozen or so pair killings. You know, everybody has sort of widely speculating on what might be causing this, but nobody has any really convincing theories. I think the only theory that to me sounds plausible explaining the type of violence is the fact that Guatemala for the past, has a 36-year civil war in which more than 200,000 people were murdered. And then there were a lot of cases of rape during the Civil War. A lot of people say that, you know, that a crime scene wasn't complete unless there was a rape. So it's kind of in this context of just a history of horrific violence that I think this is happening.
Mm. And you also write that in February, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women concluded that, I'm quoting here, government apathy and the country's weak justice system make it virtually impossible to identify the killers. Well, that was February. This is June. It sounds as if nothing has improved since then.
Yeah, I think the only change is that the government has set up a special police force to deal with women's crimes, including women police officers in Guatemala City, but the women's rights activists question whether these groups are actually being trained with the right kind of skills or whether it's just, you know, sending a bunch of women police officers out on the street isn't necessarily going to help the problem. The head of security has actually since resigned, who I quote in my story. It was one of the top officials basically saying that, you know, that these women are all involved in crime and kind of downplaying the problem. And it's not clear who the new security chief is going to be or whether the government's going to take different action.
Well, and in fact, as you say, there's some suggestion that police officers themselves may have been involved in some of these murders.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, that's something that unfortunately seems to happen throughout Latin America, where the justice system is really weak. The police officers are very poorly paid, not well screened. And there's some speculation that these women may have been witnesses to crimes committed by police officers, either in the drug trade or in league with these street gangs that have become such a problem all over Central America in particular in the past about 5 to 10 years.
One case that sounded particularly horrific involved two sisters. One of them was 11, one of them was 14.
Right. This is a case that's really shocked people. I mean, it's kind of become a frame of reference for both sides of the argument that some of the authorities say, well, this shows that the gangs were involved. One of the girls, a 14-year-old, apparently had a gang member boyfriend who she later spurned, and apparently that was the reason for the killing. However, others say, how can you possibly justify the killing of 11 and 14-year-old girls, and particularly the fact that they were cut up in pieces? I mean, it's really, really horrifying.
Can you tell us some more examples?
I interviewed several family members of two women. One was a 16-year-old beauty queen who disappeared after working in a clothing shop and later showed up with pretty much every kind of bodily violence possible. I mean, it's just truly horrific. Another case of a 30-year-old university student who disappeared from the university campus, and her family members now believe that students on campus might have been involved and that they're in cahoots with the police to cover it up. Unlike the cases in Ciudad Juarez in northern Mexico that have caused such an outcry, there doesn't seem to be a particular pattern that you can trace as to serial killings. There aren't the same kinds of markings found on the bodies. The only common element is that the killings have been done in really horrific ways.
And now there are some activist groups, certainly family members, who are speaking up about these crimes. Do you get the sense that anyone's listening?
Well, they've staged some pretty big protest marches in Guatemala City. Family members, very few of them will even speak to the press. They say that they're afraid that they may become the next victims.
Your article about these murders appeared in the Boston Globe on Monday. Have you gotten any reaction from officials in Guatemala? Has this spurred them to perhaps take another look at these cases?
I haven't gotten any reaction directly from them. I've seen a lot of noise about it on the Internet, Guatemalan newspapers making reference to it. There have been several other reports in the foreign media over the past several months. And certainly when we go in and interview government officials, they realize that this is something that's caught international attention. But there are so many cases of violence, so many problems in Guatemala that it's not clear whether this is going to be a priority. The government continues to downplay it by saying, well, these are only 7% or 8% of all murders. You know, what about the men? Mm. Whereas the women groups say, well, that's true. You know, these men, it's horrible that so many men are being killed as well, but they're not being killed with the same type of extreme, gruesome violence as the women. So something clearly is different here, and you know, we need to get to the bottom of it.
Well, Marion, thank you for your reporting.
Yes, well, thank you for having me on the show.
Marion Lloyd is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. She joined us on the line from Mexico City.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a vigil is held for American hostage Paul Johnson as the deadline set by Islamic militants approaches.
Also, Ariel Sharon survives a corruption scandal in Israel. What does that mean for Middle East peace? That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Another suicide bombing blasted through Baghdad today. This time, the target was an Iraqi army recruiting center. At least 35 people were killed and dozens more injured. Today's attacks continue a wave of violence apparently designed to undermine the new interim Iraqi government set to take power in less than 2 weeks. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Dan Murphy, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. And Dan, what can you tell us about today's bombing?
Unfortunately, that just confirms a pattern that we've been seeing for months and months now. Suicide bombings that target soft targets that tend to hit civilians who are the most exposed. And unfortunately, it tells us that the coalition is no closer to coming to grips with suicide attacks today than it was when they started almost a year ago.
Well, and actually, this bombing occurred at the same place where there was a similar bombing in February. They reinforced it. There were sandbags around. Does this tell us that there's really no protection against this kind of bombing?
Well, one can protect yourself if you are behind the sandbags, but as we've seen in a number of attacks, there are always these bottlenecks when people are waiting to get into the safe area. These men were lined up trying to get into the safe area, and so that's where people get hit. When these explosions go off, the reason you have so many civilian casualties is because those are the people without body armor, and those are the people that are in the death zone on the wrong side of the sandbags.
And what does this mean for Iraq's security in the future? Because obviously fewer people will want to join the Iraqi army and help out if they could die in the process.
What it means is, if we didn't know it already, is that 150,000 odd American troops that are here now are going to be here for the foreseeable future. The recruitment and training of both Iraqi policemen and paramilitaries and soldiers has repeatedly been slower than projected, and it's going to mean that really not as many Iraqis are going to be involved as the U.S. had been hoping.
I also want to ask you about what's happening elsewhere in Iraq, because the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has now ordered his militiamen to leave the holy cities of Najaf and Kufa. What's that about? Is al-Sadr finally backing down and retreating?
Well, he's backing down a little bit, but he's backing down second. The coalition is backed down first by dropping its demands that he be arrested. And instead, the new Iraqi leadership has convinced the Americans that he should be included in a sort of big tent. We may see in the days or weeks to come that he is given some sort of token role in the interim government that's going to take power on July 1st. So on the one hand, this is great news that he's backing off, but given what the benchmarks were for success against Al Sadr as they were set 2 months ago, that is to kill or capture him, he's got to be feeling very strong. And he's a much more prominent and important Iraqi leader today because of his defiance of the Americans than he was when this all started.
And, Dan, what about that deadline? We're now less than 2 weeks away from June 30th, the handover of power to the Iraqi interim government. Is everyone braced for just more and more violence as those days tick away?
Certainly we should expect some more attacks in the coming weeks, but we should all also expect more attacks in the coming months, especially leading up to elections scheduled for January. While a lot of this stuff does target itself at the U.S., ultimately, this is about political competition, competition for power inside Iraq, and the people that are motivated to do this stuff now are not going to lose their motivation on July 1st because there's a U.S.-installed interim government with some sovereignty. So I think what we need to prepare ourselves for is sort of continuing short, sharp attacks like the one we've had today.
Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking to us from Baghdad, Dan Murphy, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor.
It's always been conventional wisdom that ovarian cancer has no early warning symptoms. And while cervical cancer can be detected with a pap smear, there is no test as reliable for ovarian cancer, which is why, though more rare than other cancers, ovarian cancer is so deadly because it's not caught in time. But now a new study seems to confirm what ovarian cancer patients have long suspected. There are early symptoms of the disease. Joining us on the line is Dr. Howard Muntz of Seattle's Virginia Mason Medical Clinic and an author of the study. And doctor, remind us first of all, why is ovarian cancer so hard to detect?
Well, one problem is that indeed the symptoms are oftentimes vague and nonspecific. So while it is incorrect to call ovarian cancer a silent disease, indeed there are symptoms, but they frequently will be gastrointestinal in nature, and so the patient oftentimes will misascribe those to other sorts of problems.
Well, in fact, let's talk about what some of those symptoms are.
The most common symptoms of ovarian cancer are abdominal bloating, increasing abdominal girth, and frequency of urination, oftentimes described as urinary urgency.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of women have these symptoms when they have their period.
Absolutely, and that's very key that we get out to the community, that it's not necessarily time to panic if you have a little bit of menstrual discomfort, but what is quite different, though, is the ovarian cancer symptoms, which are oftentimes very severe, increasing in frequency, and oftentimes come on fairly quickly. So a patient who's been having kind of vague abdominal complaints off and on with menstruation, for instance, for a number of years, she does not have to worry, but if over, say, a period of time, 2 to 3 weeks, those symptoms get much more severe, then she should seek medical attention.
What about some of the screenings that there are for ovarian cancer? Let's say the CA-125 blood test. That's not fully reliable, is it?
That's correct. Unfortunately, we're very disappointed with our ability to screen for ovarian cancer. There simply is no comparable study like a pap smear or a mammogram. And indeed, up to half of the time when women have stage 1 ovarian cancer, which of course is exactly when we want to make that diagnosis, the CA-125 is going to be normal.
Well, so tell us, as you said, nobody wants to panic here, but if you are, let's say, having frequent urination and maybe you think it's a urinary tract infection, a chronic one, should you go to your doctor?
Well, indeed, probably you do have a urinary tract infection, and oftentimes we'll treat that just over the phone with antibiotics. But if it doesn't go away, then you need to call back and schedule an appointment to come in for an examination.
And what does that entail? How do you go farther if you think you have some of the symptoms?
Have the expectation that your physician will do a careful history as well as a detailed physical examination. And that has to include both an abdominal and pelvic examination. In our earlier survey, when we asked women what was the most common reason for their delay in diagnosis, we found that it was the omission of a pelvic examination at that first clinical encounter that oftentimes led to a physician-related delay in diagnosis.
Let's say a woman does decide, you know what, I'm having these symptoms a little more frequently and with more urgency than in the past. I'm going to go to my doctor. Can a doctor then detect ovarian cancer through a pelvic exam, or do you have to then go and have an ultrasound? In other words, how do you find it?
That's a very good question, because the pelvic examination really is just the first step, because the physician may or may not feel some type of pelvic mass. then it requires good clinical intuition to decide which patient needs to go on to receive additional diagnostic studies, such as a pelvic ultrasound, or, as you mentioned before, the CA125, while it's not perfect, is at least a good diagnostic study in that clinical circumstance. Mm.
Dr. Munz, thank you.
Great, thank you.
Dr. Howard Munz, the author of a new study on possible symptoms for ovarian cancer.
Still to come, from the Talking Heads to opera, we talk to singer David Byrne.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Carrie Enright of Belmont, Massachusetts, had a concern following our story on the reported plot by Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to assassinate Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah, so we called her up.
My concern was about the criticism about the leader of Libya. I don't understand the difference between President Bush trying to assassinate Saddam Hussein, and then he actually did assassinate his two sons, and how one is unjust and one is just, and if one is, how do you decide?
Where would you draw that line? Because some might argue that the killing of Saddam Hussein's sons was part of a war effort where Libya going after the head of Saudi Arabia was a targeted assassination.
Right. I do think that there isn't necessarily a line to be drawn. I think that to bring someone to justice is to bring them in front of a trial, in front of their accusers, and to prove that they're guilty. I don't think assassination in any way is okay.
Thank you, Carrie.
Okay, thank you.
Mark Tikowski of Bozeman, Montana, liked our interview with political scientist Stephen Walt on Ronald Reagan's legacy in Central America. But Mark took issue with Professor Walt's statement that the Sandinistas were ultimately voted out of power in Nicaragua. Mark writes, the U.S. first tried to undermine the Sandinistas covertly through the Contras. Then the U.S. imposed an embargo on Nicaragua during the 1980s. President George Herbert Walker Bush pledged in November 1989 that the trade embargo against Nicaragua would be lifted if the U.S.-backed presidential candidate, Violet Chamorro, was elected by the Nicaraguan people, and she was. Imagine if Saudi Arabia or Venezuela were to threaten the U.S. with an oil embargo unless we elected a candidate they liked. How would the U.S. react?
Kabul-based reporter Hamida Ghaffour talked to us this week. She said that Afghanistan is still struggling with a multitude of problems, and she doubted that the scheduled September elections will take place. Well, Gary Keyes of Kannapolis, North Carolina, had this response. You have a good show overall, but good news from Iraq and Afghanistan when you report on it would make it better. Sure, it's not perfect in my backyard either, but it ain't all bad. The sun comes up and the birds sing. Do the birds not sing in Baghdad? Do they even have birds there? Please report a good story from that region.
And finally, many of you wrote following the interview we did with Grover Norquist, director of the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project, about his desire to memorialize the 40th president in as many ways as possible, including putting President Reagan on the $10 bill. Well, David DeBusk of Boston called our listener line.
He thought that the $100 denomination did not get used very often. Well, I think it's the bill of choice for arms dealers, and I think the $100 bill would be a perfect choice for Ronald Reagan's memory. It would be a memorial to Iran-Contra.
Guy Washburn of Arlington, Massachusetts, had another suggestion. The only currency Reagan's image should be on is the $1,000 bill. That way, only his supporters would have to look at it.
And Steve Razov of Drexel Hill, Pennsylvania, had this to say. I'd select another bill as being more appropriate, but we're saving the picture on the $3 bill for George W. Bush.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
David Byrne's music has never been the same as it ever was. The former Talking Heads frontman helped usher in the video age with that puffed-up white suit and tiny little head. He brought us the hits Psycho Killer and Burning Down the House. And after the Talking Heads' ugly breakup in 1991, he continued to pioneer with movies, books, his own record label. He even used the slideshow program PowerPoint to make art. David Byrne is always experimenting, and now opera is his latest love. Byrne says arias were the pop songs of their day, and on his new CD, Grown Backwards, he hits the high notes on not one, but two pieces. Unde Felice is from La Traviata.
It felt great singing those songs. I'm not a huge opera aficionado, but I heard some of them recently, and I realized, oh, those are within my range. I could sing those just as a song. And I thought, well, I'm going to give it a try. Now, producer Andrea Shea spoke with David Byrne about his latest passion and his new CD as he set out on tour.
You asked Rufus Wainwright to join you on Au Fond du Temple Saint. It's a Bizet piece from his opera, The Pearl Fishers. Did you do that because you knew Rufus Wainwright was an opera fan, or did you do it because you needed a little help with your pronunciation?
I knew that Rufus was an opera fan. I'd worked at as a host on a small PBS program called Sessions at West 54th Street, and amongst the various musicians, he was one of the guests, and found out that he was a big opera fan. This song is a duet, two guys singing about a woman, and I needed another singer to sing with me. Well, it seemed like kind of a no-brainer. Here was this guy who lives in New York now, who not only probably knew this piece of music, but speaks that language too. He knew the piece. He had a favorite recording of it that he wanted us to reference.
And what recording was that?
It was one by, I think he's a Swedish singer, Jussi Björling or something like that. I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but maybe that's kind of the definitive recording of that song.
Until now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were first exposed to classical music when you were in high school in Baltimore, digging through the public library, perhaps. Were you a musical kid?
Yeah, eventually, probably like a lot of kids, I thought, look at all these people forming bands. I'm going to learn to play guitar. And then eventually I had a little tape recorder where I could record stuff. And my dad helped me do a thing where I could kind of multi-track, because those kind of things weren't available at the time. So I could kind of do little experiments at home. And at that time, I seem to remember a routine of coming home after school every day and immediately putting on a record. And, you know, as kids do, putting on the same record every day for a month, just wearing it out.
You wrote the song Empire, which is on your new CD a few years ago. It's a satirical kind of an anthem, but you never released it, and now here it is on your new CD. So why did you hold on to it, and why are you letting it out now?
Yeah, it's a song I wrote some years ago, and both musically and thematically it seemed, well, inappropriate for some of my previous records. Now, with the title Empire and the kind of world events and the world perception of as America as an empire, that doesn't seem like such a strange, far-fetched idea now. It is political in the fact that it's a very ironic take on kind of the maybe more Republican view of things. But you'd only know it was ironic by the fact that I'm singing it. I think if Toby Keith sang it, everybody would take it at face value.
In national elections, in songs raised on high, with stirring emotions, as tears fill our eyes, in democratic fever for national defense, I am a mountain.
You're obviously political. You were against invading Iraq. You, in the lead-up to the war, organized a full-page petition in the New York Times with a number of other artists, Brian Eno, Suzanne Vega.
Outkast, Missy Elliott, 50 Cent.
So do you think artists and art has the power to make change?
Obviously not. I think they have the power to kind of influence the way people think about things. But that's a kind of slow kind of perceptual change.
It's like your own campaign to win the hearts and minds.
Exactly, and that's something that just takes a long time.
Young artists and writers, please heed the call. What's good for business is good for us all.
You've been so prolific, photography, video, art, film, you're an author, you had your own record label, and most artists have rough patches where they're experiencing a block. Does that ever happen to you? And when it does, what do you do?
I think I've had rough patches. I haven't experienced a block. I just keep producing things, but they're not as good, which is a shame because I think they're kind of okay at the time. But in retrospect, I think there have been times when I've done things that weren't as strong.
Like what?
Oh, I think there's some songs I've put out that, to me, don't stand the test of time.
Your biggest hit since your days with the Talking Heads has been Lazy, and it was a collaboration with the London house trio Express 2. It's played in dance clubs all over the world. I know it's really popular in Rio. It's also rearranged on your new CD. Does its popularity surprise you?
Yeah, it surprised me that was such a big success, partly because it wasn't done with that intention. It was just done for fun.
To be getting through an interview without one single question about the Talking Heads?
No, it doesn't. I have my answers, so it's not completely forbidden. I still perform a lot of those songs, and I'm proud of a lot of what the band did. I'm actually, of course, just as excited about a lot of the other stuff I've done since then, and so I tend not to live in the past.
David Byrne speaking with Here and Now producer Andrea Shea. His new CD is called Grown Backwards.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. We'll be right back.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.